Our agenda is here. I'm getting echo from you, Marcus.
Yeah, I can mute myself.
Okay. So the agenda's there. First up to scribe is Nicholas, who's not here. How convenient. Greg, would you mind would you mind scribing?
I'll scribe.
Thank you. All right. Any updates or additions to the agenda before we start?
Oh, yeah, there was one thing that came to mind following a tag conversation regarding the use of fragment identifiers in JSON-LD. I'm wondering whether we need to have something in our IANA considerations that describes how fragment identifiers are to be interpreted.
Mm. Yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to. So do we have to say something if the yeah, I guess we do have to say something if the IRI.
Well, I think the wording I've seen is that it falls back to the base MIME type, but so the idea being that you need to be able to follow your nose through MIME types and document references, and there is nothing that you can find. JSON pointer looks like it might do something with that, but of course that's also a different MIME subtype. So I think it just needs a statement to say what the meaning is, but I wasn't able to. I don't know it enough, and it maybe it can just wait until we get to a some point prior to a W3C FPWD when someone that really cares about this stuff more.
Yeah.
I think we don't have to specify it. We can also just leave it undefined.
Well, so we probably should specify it because it's going to become a tag issue at some point. We went through the same thing with RDFA. What we should do is just turn it into an issue and leave it as an open issue so we don't forget. And then we can discuss it later. I mean, you know, with the RDFA spec, we ended up putting in some kind of vague wording about what a fragment identifier is. This is the whole, I mean, you know, this is all HTTP range 14 territory, so we can't, as a community, we can't seem to come to a decision on what exactly, you know, is the best way forward for that, other than
I'll mint new IRIs
using a fragment.
Well, RDFA is a bit different because those fragments have a meaning in HTML, but they have no meaning in JSON at all.
Well, there's also, I mean, RDFA doesn't just apply to HTML, it applies to XML and SVG as well. Marcus, you're partially right, and I think that it's a deeper issue. It's more of an academic discussion, I think, than anything else. I mean, I think people use fragment identifiers to mint new IRIs, and that's it, without much thought put into the exact meaning of the fragment identifier. In any case, we should raise an issue on this and just kind of leave it.
Okay, we'll create an issue for that.
Okay, thank you, Marcus. Anything else? Anything else that we should discuss on the agenda or add to the agenda?
Not really. That's not really for the agenda or for the meetings. It's just I had some interesting talks last week at the conference and also some interesting conversations with a lot of companies, big companies.
I'm sorry, Marcus. Sorry to interrupt. Let's take some time at the beginning of the call for you to kind of give us an idea about what happened. Could you summarize it in about 10 minutes?
Yeah, I think in 2 minutes as well.
Okay, good.
So
which sorry again, which conference was this?
It was the .com conference in France, Lyon. And Well, the first day there was the linked data workshop where Tim Berners-Lee and all the RDF guys, so to speak, were present, and Tim Berners-Lee kind of, well, I should say that he said that he doesn't see much value in another serialization of RDF in JSON because it's really the same, it's just another serialization, and we shouldn't do the same mistake as with XML again.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that also caused some conversations on Twitter, and actually I think that was quite good because a lot of people attended my talk then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of the people understood, or after showing them a couple of examples, they really saw the difference between RDF XML and JSON-LD, because JSON-LD still feels like native JSON, and RDF XML clearly does not. And yeah, I talked also to quite a number of companies or developers from companies, and they say mostly they started looking at it, did some experiment prototypes with it, but they're still mostly waiting for the syntax to become stable to, you know, get their hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And quite some people said that the biggest thing that they are missing, or the only thing that really prevents them to convert their legacy JSON to JSON-LD, is that they can't simply convert the IDs. So the IRIs in there quite often have to be converted to an absolute IRI by using an IRI template. So you can't just, you know, trick it as treat it as a relative IRI, or that, or just aliasing the ID keyword. You would need something like IRI templates to handle those cases.
Hmm.
But most of them, when I pointed them to the JSON-LD macros, then I think that's Melvin's work, they kind of agreed that that's something, or that could be something that would help them to convert the legacy JSON-LD to JSON to JSON-LD.
So unfortunately, I'm not that familiar with the JSON-LD macro stuff. I know Melvin pointed me to it. I don't think it's Melvin's stuff. It's somebody else's stuff that Melvin's very excited about.
And
I can't really remember.
I think it's Antonio Garo.
Yeah,
oh, yeah,
that's right, Greg.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So two responses. The first one is the remarks about JSON-LD being basically like RDF XML. So I've had a couple of discussions with other folks. Marcus, I'm going to mute you just because we're picking up a lot of noise on your.
Oh yeah, I will mute myself. Sorry.
So one of the discussions that we have, Greg and I both agree that we think Tim Biel is a bit off on that statement, meaning that RDF XML is a serialization of RDF in XML, and it's not very helpful. This is Ted Thibodeau actually said this as well. So RDF XML is primarily a serialization of RDF in XML. It's not very easy for humans to read. It's fairly difficult for developers to use the data structure. It's just got a slew of issues that we've discussed many times over. So JSON-LD is different in that it just so happens that JSON-LD can be converted to RDF, but it is not seen primarily as an RDF serialization mechanism, right? It's a linked data format for people that are used to doing web-type programming, so people that work in Python and Ruby and JavaScript and basically want this set of linked data objects to basically work with. And I think the most important thing to understand is that JSON-LD is not just a RDF serialization mechanism. It's a different type of linked data format. And most of the people we talked with after the fact seemed to agree with that. And I think, Marcus, you said that a lot of the people that attended your talk seemed to understand that the RDF XML and JSON-LD are two very different beasts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I think it's important. So what I think we should do is not necessarily ignore this, but make a very concerted blog post saying, look, this is the difference between JSON-LD and RDF XML, because this is inevitably going to come up over and over again. So we should definitely, you know, write about it. I don't know. It would probably be best to write about it before we went into the RDF working group. And I might have some time to write something very quick about it in the next week. I don't know how either of your time is this week, but we should probably just get this kind of dealt with quickly and move on. The JSON-LD macros stuff, Marcus, I'm guessing you're saying that they need something like a URI template, and that's something that they'd want to put in the context. They don't want to do any kind of like processing for all of their objects. Is that
no? The thing was, I kind of I was talking mostly to REST people,
mm-hmm.
So they have JSON web APIs already, and they, I don't know, they would or maybe plan to upgrade them to JSON-LD. So I showed them. I showed an example how you can upgrade a legacy JSON API to JSON-LD,
mm-hmm.
And I made use of, well, the ID in that object was already a relative IRI, so I just aliased the ID keyword. But a lot of people can't really do that because it's not always a relative IRI, it's just a string which has to be put in into a IRI template to get the real IRI out of it.
Mm.
So I didn't talk about that during my talk, but afterwards at the discussions and offline, and they just didn't know about the JSON-LD macros. So I just pointed them to them, and they were mostly fine with that. It's not that they asked that to go into the main spec. It's just that they didn't see any way to do that. No. Well, declarative way, so to speak.
Hmm. Well, I think we should certainly make this an issue and kind of look at it in more depth. I kind of hate to do it at this point. It would be. Do you think that you could reach out and ask a couple of those? Do you have contact information for some of those people? Like, could we? It would be best if they kind of outlined what their use case was, or if we could outline a use case that we could kind of use to solve this issue. Otherwise, I'm afraid that we might end up solving an issue that they don't feel that they necessarily have.
Well, quite a lot of people were saying, I have some contact details, but not that many about that specific thing. Most of them were kind of, they already had an API in place, which was, well, had all the data in there, but it wouldn't be that simple to just add a context because of that ID issue there, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So otherwise, you could just even just add that link header, HTTP link header.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a pretty good grasp of what the issue is? Like, could you type up a use case that we could kind of, barring them talking about it directly, maybe you could write up a quick use case on it so that we could think about it a bit more and try and solve it.
Yeah, I could do that, yeah.
Okay.
That was quite an issue, so we can discuss that next week.
Yeah, and that is going to be a pretty high priority thing to do because that does affect the syntax potentially.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else on WWW 2012 before we move on?
Did you have any more interaction with the Wikidata folks?
No, I couldn't find any Wikidata guy, so you sent me the details, but wasn't able to get in touch with them. And
there was
I tried to contact them via Twitter, but, well,
yeah, I had
didn't get anything back.
I had some initial discussions with them and have done a fair amount of interaction on their model page on the project wiki. And I've shown a number of ways in which they can express facts in they call them SNCs, I think, using JSON-LD. But I don't think I've made the case, and sort of the interaction's fallen off. So I think they may just sort of by default continue down their own route with some proprietary JSON representation. I'm not exactly sure how to forward that thing along any further at this point.
Do we know that's what they're doing?
No, I just haven't seen any more work on it. Let me see if I can find a page for it.
Is there any specific reason why they don't look further into the JSON-LD?
I've advocated it somewhat. Let me see if I find the model description. It just might be that they're not able to spend more time on it. They do work a lot with volunteers, and I've just, even though I very well may get quite involved with wiki stuff myself, I'm considering a position at Wikia.
Cool.
I don't really know that much about it at this point. I'm still searching for that model page. Yeah, well, just keep going. I'll keep looking. Oh, there
this
we are.
One here?
That's the model in JSON. That's not the. That was the first level of discussion. There is another data model page. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, here we are. And then it was mostly in the talk page. Here we are. That I used most of my examples and sort of related it to trig, really, as a way of sort of describing the markup and then how that would be represented in a JSON-LD. So some of there's some criticism in there from Markets Krulch related to potentially the granularity of using a one graph per statement, and how that sort of is not in keeping with the way that many people use multiple graphs. And I don't really see another way around that if we use a graph syntax to be able to create assertions on the statement itself.
Are you saying the solution to that is the graph syntax we're considering, or are you saying that the graph syntax we're considering is not a solution to the problem that he raised?
It's really not at this point, it's not really a syntax issue. It's a modeling issue, since the same would be true with a trig syntax. The way that they had been thinking before, I think, had more to do with reification and reifying statements to be able to make assertions about them, which can be done in addition to having some form of a named graph thing. Now, my understanding in sort of following some of the work on the RDF working group is that DBpedia actually makes one basic, you know, context or separate graph per statement, so that they can describe the provenance of each statement separately. So I think it's probably not an unreasonable way to do it, but I think that's one the problem we get into with named graphs is that some people want to use named graphs, say, for reifying individual providing provenance for individual pieces of an overall repository, and others perhaps want to do it to describe the, say, different files that perhaps have been imported, different graphs that have been imported into a repository, which is more in line, I think, with the way that named graphs are used in Sparkle. From a model theoretic point, the things are pretty equivalent. It just comes down to practically what is it that they want to use when they're representing their data. And down at the what they call the SNCC level, which basically describes a statement and then all of the assertions upon that statement, you know, where it came from, whatnot. I think that probably is a reasonable way to model it. But when you get to, say, a larger wiki, where you've got much more stuff involved, then that level of granularity perhaps isn't as useful. So it struck me that perhaps if there was a way to turn the graphs upside down, so rather than having statements which can include a graph, that you might have a graph that references the assertions upon it. So if you want to have one statement be in more than one graph, for instance, our syntax, and indeed trig syntax, doesn't really address that.
Could we solve that by allowing a string value for @graph, which references or names the graph itself?
Well, right now we use an object value for graph to describe the actual graph. What we need is, if we had something more like in graph, that might be another way to do it. Of course, being linked data, you could also have a graph reference an IRI, which means that you could reference the same IRI for multiple graphs, and that might be one way to deal with it. But I don't think these are really syntax issues. I just encourage other people in this group to go through the data model talk page in particular and see if you can help to bolster the case there. Because I see this as a important and natural fitting design win for JSON LD.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I hadn't looked too deeply about that, at that page. Or I looked at it at the very beginning, but I hadn't seen any of these responses. So, yeah, maybe we can come up with a solution for them. Okay. Anything else on www.2012 and Wikidata before we move on?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. All right. First topic up is issue 106, JSON LD 10 graph syntax. Get the link to the issue here. So we have decided, we made the decision that we're going to try and tackle the graph syntax in JSON LD a couple of weeks ago. This issue is basically to try and get an idea of all of the concerns that we have about a graph syntax, what's allowed, what isn't allowed. So if you look at the issue, there are six basic assertions that I think we're making. I'm just going to put these in IRC. So those are the things that we're basically, I think that's my read, at least from the group, of what we're saying name graphs are in JSON LD. So we're going to support name graphs by having ID and graph at the same level, where the ID expresses the name of the graph. The name of the graph can be an IRI, or it can be a bnode-like label. So we're going to support bnode-like labels for graphs. The graph keyword may be aliased. And this is the, so this next one is the one where the Wikidata thing might change stuff. The graph keyword is always associated with an IRI in JSON, represented by either a string, which is an IRI, an object with an ID, which is, you know, a JSON LD object, or an array of objects with IDs, so for disjoint graphs. A JSON LD property may be associated with a graph object. That basically means that any statement can point off to another graph, and so that has some strange ramifications. That doesn't have any strange ramifications with properties, but it could have strange ramifications with things like type, and let's see, things like value. So the last one says that JSON-LD keywords must not be associated with a graph object, especially ID and value. Is there anything else that we need to discuss? So there's this. We need to also talk about graph when we're compacting, expanding, and framing, and that might be a fairly in-depth discussion.
The document state currently, I think, is consistent with this. It describes the impact of graphs on compaction and expansion. It does not for framing. Dave Longley and I have had some discussions about how to integrate graphs with framing, and that's probably where it has the biggest impact. By the way, the RDF transformation to and from have also been updated for graph. So I think we're pretty consistent with what you said here. I don't quite understand point 5, the property may be associated with a graph object.
It's not saying anything magical. It's basically saying that you can have like FOF organization point off to another graph.
So FOF organization could have as its value a subject definition which includes a graph.
Let's see. The wording you're using is a bit tricky, so I don't know. I think
subject definition is a term I added in order to be able to describe JSON objects that include an ID or are interpreted as. Subject definition and subject reference were too useful to not be able to normalize.
Okay.
Them.
So basically, what you said and what Marcus put in the IRC channel.
Well, now if you use at graph without an ID embedded, then it is also interpreted as an object. In which case, this describes a named graph with an anonymous B node.
Yep.
As the
that's
name.
Correct. Yep. Yeah. So that's what five says.
Yeah, I think that the documents are pretty consistent with this interpretation. The biggest outlying thing right now is the impact of graph on framing. And I think our thought right now is the easiest way to deal with that is to say that framing merges all of these statements. So framing basically happens in the merge space of all graphs. Now, currently it won't do that because it does not descend into at graph. Hmm. If it were to descend into at graph, then it would basically flatten everything out at the same level. Mm-hmm. The way that we might want to impose it is if a frame includes at graph within it, then it is not in a flattened graph space, and the components of each graph are flattened separately. So first flattening starts with everything that doesn't have a graph in it, and this being everything other than, of course, graph at the very top level object. Mm-hmm. And then you flatten individually in each graph, then you could have some semantics where you reference graphs, and it causes it basically to traverse into each of the named graphs. Probably requires a way to identify which graphs you want to speak of, so introducing the use of some ID matching in a frame so that you can find specific graphs based upon their identifiers. But it wasn't all in all, it wasn't something we wanted to get into right now, and perhaps in JSON 1.0, we only support flattened graphs for framing.
Yeah. As long as we have a way of expanding it out to non-flattened slash named graphs in JSON-LD next, that would be fine. We don't want to paint ourselves in a corner.
regarding point four, you're saying there that the value of at graph is always represented either as an object or a string. Currently, we don't support strings.
What I meant is that at graph is an ID, if that makes sense. You know how we say an ID is always an ID can be. Actually, no, now we've changed that, haven't we? The what I'm trying to say with that statement is that it's an identifier, right? So at graph points to an identifier. It's either something that's a string, which will be interpreted as an IRI or B node, or it's an object that contains an ID in it. And if it doesn't contain an ID in it, a B node will be generated for that object. Does that make
sense? Don't think that's really true. The at graph contains the graph. The ID of the graph is at the same level as at graph. So that's a bit different, I think.
Could you type out an example? I'm not following.
So if you have at graph, the contents of that graph are the value, but the ID of the graph, the name of the graph itself, is on the same level. I'm just typing.
Yeah, the ID is in an object. An object has an at ID and an at graph. The at ID is the name of the things that are in the graph. I think that what Mono was saying wasn't that at graph is an ID, but that at graph took as values a string, which is interpreted as an IRI reference, or a object, in which case it's a graph composed of at least one root statement, or an array of strings or objects.
But
yes. What
happens if there's just one string, for example?
So basically what that would say is that you have a graph, and the components of the graph are associated with that ID, so as linked data, when you dereference that ID, you could get another JSON-LD document which describes some set of statements. And so the referencing document would basically say that the group of the interpretation of dereferencing that document would be a graph with a particular name. And this sort of falls afoul of, I think, a lot of the semantics that say that named graphs are always inside of an at graph. Although potentially, you know, it could work that way. Some other stuff that's going on in, I think, Pat Hayes' latest recommendation for, I think, context, he's calling it, RDF contexts, is that this is being able to reference a set of, in RDF, a set of statements as being in a graph is necessary but not sufficient. You also would need to add something to the graph itself that describes, to a statement itself that describes that those statements form some form of a graph. I think this is, of course, this is partly why Mono was hoping we didn't get into this right now, because the specifics are still in debate. And I think that meaning is something that's premature for us to discuss here. And we just want to try to limit ourselves to syntax as much as possible for how you express these things, looking for trig as a model for being able to express graphs.
Well, but I think that's really syntax related, isn't it?
Well, syntax and semantics related. It's more semantics related.
I think if you're using,
it's a string, right? But semantics.
If you're using IRIs as the value part of a graph, then I think that's entirely consistent with our being linked data. And if you had a graph that did not allow you to specify the contents of the graph through linking, then I think that would be not in keeping with the intention of JSON-LD as a mechanism for expressing linked data.
Yeah.
So you might say that if you have a graph which is an array of objects, that's what we describe now. If you have a graph of an object, then that's coerced to an array of objects. If you have a graph that's an ID or an array of ID or some mixture of ID and object, then I think that it's like saying that when you dereference that ID, that the resulting JSON is basically inserted into the graph.
So that would mean JSON ID processor has to go dereference that and include it into the expanded output, for example.
I don't think the processor needs to do that. I think that's just the just as the processor, you can use IRIs in many other places to create linked data, but the processor is never required to dereference those IRIs to include the information. That is left to the application. Same would be the case here. If you have a graph reference an IRI, you're making an assertion about those without actually imposing a requirement that the process dereference that. You leave that to the application.
Okay. So it would basically be the same as having an object with just an @ID in there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's basically like saying @graph has the default context for @graph has @type of @ID, and that cannot be overridden. So if I were to expand a document with @graph referencing a string, I would replace that with a object containing an ID or a subject reference.
In expanded form, we don't automatically generate bnode IDs in expanded form, do we?
No, only in framing.
Yeah, so...
But this doesn't relate to that. So
okay.
Type something out.
Yeah.
If I've got, let's say, @ID.
Marcus, that's right, what you just typed in IRC.
That would expand out to @ID. Something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the expansion algorithm does right now.
Okay. All right. Well, it seems to me at a high level
that would be an array. So
right.
Expand that out to an array containing a single object with an ID.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, let me mark it up.
Trying to
think. So graph is
right.
Basically treated like any property that has a type of ID.
Mm-hmm.
For expansion and compaction.
Mm-hmm. Something doesn't feel right about that. I'm trying to figure out what it is. No, I guess that's right. For whatever reason, I was thinking that the @graph would expand out into at graph and then an array of objects, and then that the last item you have there, ID is HTTP colon slash slash bar, would have an at graph in there, but that's redundant, I think.
Yeah, so this is just saying that graph used to reference a string, which is interpreted as an IRI.
Mm-hmm.
So when you expand, properties are put into an array form,
mm-hmm.
and IRIs are expanded except for type and ID.
Right.
We don't expand them there, but with graph, we would expand it here.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I think that makes sense. Marcus, do you have any...
The last point you have on there is about, can you have at graph include statements that have at graphs in them?
Actually, the last item has more to do with, can you have JSON-LD keywords point to...
No, I'm sorry, after the last point. We also need to figure out how a graph is treated with compacting. I misread what you were saying that. So what would it mean if you had ID, an object with ID and graph, which references an array that includes an object of ID and graph? How is that interpreted? And I think for framing purposes, basically all the everything that references a graph is in the default, basically in the default graph. So if I have a graph, a named graph, which includes an object that has a named graph, it when it is framed or flattened, the identifier for that second named graph is put at the very top frame or in the default graph. But the other properties asserted about that stay in the original named graph.
Okay, let's see. Can you type out a quick example?
Yeah, let me try.
Yeah.
I find that at graph with a string value a bit misleading if you just read it without having, you know.
Well, I mean, we could make it a legal syntax to do that, but I think the side effect that that's going to have is someone's going to basically be like, well, what happens if I want to reference a graph out on the web? How do I do that? And I guess our response could be, well, you have to use an object, you have to use at ID and at, you know, you have to use an object. But then, you know, the next step is, well, why can't I just use an IRI? Because it seems overly verbose to have to use a, you know, have to use this object that has an ID in it to express the IRI when I should be able to just do it directly.
Yeah, completely understand the motivation. Just if you read it that way, it's really, even for me, misleading because it could even say that object is in that graph if there is just an IRI, which could name the graph itself as well. But yeah, I understand the motivation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, well, one of the other problems with graph syntax is that it's, you know, we're in a kind of a fuzzy territory. I think we're being fairly consistent here, but there are many ways that people could interpret graph, and I think that that also might be because we haven't really worked with graphs that much in the RDF world for a very long time, meaning that you don't find them in very many systems. So what they could mean is kind of, it could mean anything because we haven't really decided what they mean. I think you have a point, Marcus. I don't know if there's much that we can do about it. Let's see, I'm reading.
I don't know if it's any clearer spelling it out without some using some better use of white spaces and new lines. But basically what this is saying is you have a you have a named graph identified by foo, which references an object identified by bar that has a property, say foo, and a graph itself, which has property baz. This is basically saying that ID bar exists both in the named graph foo and in the default graph. In the named graph foo, it contains the property, say foo, in the default graph, it includes it is the name of another graph. And everything that's expressed there, so property baz is in that named graph.
Okay, hold on. I lost you halfway through.
It is confusing.
Yeah.
I think it requires a better example that to be typed out, maybe.
Yeah. Hold on. In the default graph, I'm trying to, let's see. ID bar exists in name graph foo in the default graph.
I didn't use enough nonsense words to.
Yeah, we need to type this out. It's very, very difficult to follow in RFC. Although, again, this has to do with compaction only, right? It's not the I don't think that the
actually,
compaction
only
decision,
has to do with framing. It doesn't relate to
framing.
Yeah.
I meant framing. So it only has to do with framing. We don't think that this is going to affect the syntax any. It's just the number of square brackets and curly braces you end up using. Is that more or less
right?
Right. Okay. So we don't have a syntax discussion at this point. We have a what does the RDFA API or sorry the JSON-LD API do with this input, right? And we think that the syntax will support anything that it decides to do. We just haven't figured out exactly what it needs to do yet. Is that a fair?
Yeah, and because the other thing is, if you look at the impact on the RDF document, the RDF APIs, so it's useful to see what happens when you take one of these graphs, turn it into RDF, and then turn that back into JSON-LD. When you turn it into RDF, basically all the graph identifiers become the fourth element in a quad. And when you go from RDF back into JSON-LD, you've basically flattened everything else out so that there is a default graph and then there is a named graph for everything based upon the distinct fourth elements in each quad.
So you basically get the ID and the graph back when you go from quads back to JSON-LD.
Yes,
meaning that it's a lossless.
It's going to remove the nesting.
Oh, okay.
And that's basically the interpretation I was saying that we could have with framing. In fact, framing, the first step in framing is a flattening operation, and it is almost equivalent to say that you could flatten by turning the document into RDF and then from RDF back into JSON-LD, and the result of that would be the same as flattening. The only difference is that you lose order, whereas the flattening algorithm maintains the order of elements from the original document. So that's the reason to not do that. But otherwise, the graphs are somewhat isomorphic.
Okay. All right. So I think we have consensus on this, at least consensus on the 6 points in the issue, and then what potential way forward for framing? I don't see any. I'm not very concerned about what's been proposed today. Meaning, I think that let's go ahead and use these as the ground rules, and then see how far that gets us. Any disagreement, Greg, Marcus?
I think it's something that we're going to have to do. In fact, I think that if RDFA does a 1.2, it's going to be to add support for named graphs.
Don't say that. Don't say there's going to be another RDFA. Yes,
well,
I agree.
I think
named
graphs
are
going to become important.
Yeah. Okay. So the proposal here is going to be adopt the 6 points in issue 106 along with Greg's outline for framing as the way that we're going to approach graphs in JSON-LD. Okay, so adopt the 6 points in issue 106 along with Greg and Longley's proposal for graph processing and framing as a way we approach name graph support. Okay. And then plus 1, minus 1, plus 0.
Related question to that. Would it make sense to have a separate flatten operation or something like that in the API?
There is an algorithm that describes flatten, and it's not currently called out as an API, but I think there is some value in doing that, definitely.
Yeah, we had discussed it in so the JSON-LD API started out with a separate flatten method, and then we merged it in because we weren't using it. So you know, if somebody else thinks that they're gonna be using it pretty heavily, then we could probably pull it out.
Well, another example where flatten is useful is say for Nicholas RDF. A to JSON-LD, where he'll create multiple objects with the same ID. Mm-hmm. And flattening is useful then in combining those multiple objects into a single object and still keeping it as JSON-LD.
Okay. Well, maybe we could raise an issue on it and put that discussion to a later time. Marcus, would you mind opening an issue on that?
Yeah, I will do that.
Great, thanks. Okay, anything else on issue 106 before we move on? Okay, issue 102, can JSON-LD keywords be redefined in the context? Here's issue 102. So this basically outlines, the place that we got hung up on this issue was whether or not you could override type, right? I think we agree that you should not be able to override things like ID and context and value. So the JSON-LD keyword shouldn't be overridden. Type is the only outlier here. So Marcus had a proposal. There were two proposals on what we should do when people try to override JSON-LD keywords. One of them is to allow them to be overridden, but warn developers that bad things will happen if they do that. The second one is to throw an exception if somebody tries to redefine the JSON-LD keyword. And the third option that Marcus put down was that we ignore any kind of overriding statement except for type. So what we might want to do is, at least I liked Marcus's idea that we should just ignore those statements. But one concern I had is that if those statements are invalid, we should probably throw an exception, because we don't want people using the statement thinking that it's doing something and then spending lots of time trying to figure out why this redefinition of the keyword isn't working for them. So I guess...
But does it really have to be an exception? I mean, there could be a lock message or something in the different libraries as well.
Wait, say that again? There could be what?
A lock message. I mean, if you write the library, you can log it to the console in JavaScript, for example, or...
Yeah, but I guess the statement has... It's not like, I guess the statement is not like a regular properties, like properties that we don't understand in the document, right? This is something that's in the context that's very specific to JSON-LD, and the author has basically created the JSON-LD context, which is invalid. We tend to throw exceptions whenever there's invalid stuff in the context. Right, because we're not dealing with legacy data in that case. We're dealing with stuff that people have authored. If we ignore the statements, it could mean that people have this markup in their documents and they'll have it for many, many years. And then if we decide to actually do something with JSON-LD keywords being redefined in the future, then there's a potential backwards incompatibility issue. So I guess the main reason for throwing an exception are twofold. The first one is we don't want to create a backwards compatibility issue when we don't need to. And the second one is we want to be very clear that this is just not allowed. You're not allowed to override JSON-LD keywords. And we're doing that to save the developer time and trying to figure out why that redefinition isn't working for them. Does that make sense, Marcus, or would you still
want
to ignore
it? Yeah, it does make sense. It's just maybe that we prevent some innovations or some use cases in that instance. So, for example, Nicholas couldn't change his system to, you know, support his use case in a proprietary way.
We do have a solution for Nicholas's use case, right? And that is we allow the overriding of type because it's one of those special things. Or we might just do, you know, RDF colon type or, you know, something along those lines. So we do allow the overriding of that, so he doesn't have to create a proprietary solution. So then the question becomes what potential innovation, you know, do we think that, you know, that's there. And I think that it's very, from a design perspective, it's dangerous to say, well, let's not disallow this because somebody may innovate on top of it. I think there are parts of the language where we want people to innovate on top of it and parts where we don't necessarily want people to innovate on top of it because there might be some future compatibility issues associated with that. So I think that this is, and again, this is, you know, a design decision. This is a soft science. So I'm wary of us allowing innovation to happen in this area as a kind of an open field approach to it, right? We don't know how people would innovate on top of this, and we might actually end up defining this more specifically in the future. And since we can't think of any use cases for how people would innovate on top of this, I think we should throw an exception until we do know at least one way that people could innovate on top of this. I agree.
Okay, yeah, that's fine for me.
Okay. I guess then the proposal would be JSON-LD keywords must not be redefined in the context. The JSON-LD processor should throw an exception if it detects a JSON-LD keyword being redefined. And I guess the exception to this rule is that type can be redefined. And in the future, we might choose to rename type to something else. So that it's not confusing to people that want to override type.
Well, so why is that necessary that that we allow at type to be overridden? Why can't Nicholas just use another property which he treats like type?
I don't know. Marcus, do you remember Nicholas's argument on that? I feel like we discussed it.
No, he said he would be fine with doing that. We weren't just really sure if that's possible with the current algorithms, because in the from RDF algorithm, it's automatically translated to a type. That was the issue, I think.
So we would need to modify
the from RDF algorithms to check for that case if we can't directly map it to at type from RDF column type. But I think that change would solve Nicholas' issue.
Yeah,
so that would be an option to the RDF processor, to the RDF from RDF algorithm to give it a different property use for type.
Well, I think it would be a detection, right? You would detect to see if there are any other attributes associated with.
You can't do that from RDF. It's just in from RDF. It's the predicate is RDF type.
Yeah, and then the type's something completely different.
So there's not really a way to say use something other than at type for describing that, except through some flag to the algorithm, which I don't know.
I mean, Nicholas could already, I think, address his use case by not using the from RDF algorithm at the moment.
Yeah.
Because it's completely valid JSON-LD at the moment already. So I don't know if we even need to do something.
I would say at this point we should just disallow all keywords from being overridden in context. And then we can address that with amendment later on if we feel there's really an important reason to do it for type. Otherwise, it really just opens the door to, well, if type, then why not language? Why not whatever? And,
yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with that.
And the fact that, from RDF is just an algorithm to do it does not mean it's the only way to turn RDF into JSON-LD.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I think she was also more concerned if it's really supported and if it's if it's still in there after expansion and after compaction. But after having looked at the algorithms, I think that, or I'm sure that's the case. It's just that from RDF algorithm that causes that issue. I don't know if it's even an issue.
Okay, so the proposal is, let's see, JSON-LD keywords must not be defined in the context if a JSON-LD processor detects that a JSON-LD keyword is being redefined, it must throw an exception. Are those the only two things? Okay, so that's the proposal. Okay. That is that issue. So that's issue 102. Anything else on this issue before we move on? Okay, issue 103 is whether or not we should reintroduce data type as value type. This came up during that same sort of discussion, I think. Two things came out of that type discussion. One of them is that we would want type to be redefined. to something else. And then the other issue that came up is that we've seen a couple of cases where people mistake what type, they don't understand that type is context sensitive, meaning that when it's used inside of an object that's not expanded form, it means RDF type. When it's used inside of an object that has a value, it means it's specifying the data type effectively of the value. So the question here is whether or not we reintroduce data type as value type. So you would say at value equals something, and then you do at value type is something like XSD integer.
But what was really the confusion? RDF people that didn't find the at data type, or I mean, there can't be any, like, there's just something that you can't find, but it's not something that you can misinterpret, right?
I think so. The majority. So one of the things was from someone that was very, very knowledgeable about RDF. The other one was at one point Dave Lane had done some markup that had misinterpreted what type does, and I think someone else on the mailing list had specified this as a concern or an issue. So it's people that have basically some RDF background knowledge. I don't know if that is playing heavily into whether or not they get confused about type or not.
So my thought is, having, because I think I weighed in on the side of going back to data type or value type, is that I don't think it's compelling enough to want to make a big change to the language right now. And what I see is the market is looking for us to stabilize the syntax. And I think that this is what we established right now. It's not unreasonable. All of the algorithms are well described with it. It's implemented in many different languages. So I would just say we keep the use of at type as it is today and don't introduce something else.
And Marcus, you said that you would be that's your preference as well?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So then the proposal is,
By the way, actually, sorry to back up to 102. When we said that keywords can't be overridden, did we mean that anything that begins with an at cannot be defined?
No, we meant we
specifically defined keywords.
Yeah.
That does raise a similar issue, though, if we decide to add a keyword later on, such as value type, that someone else has used, then it's going to create, well, I guess what would happen is we would now throw an exception over a use of something that had been done before, which at least wouldn't make it invisible.
Yeah, I agree with you that we would probably want to throw an exception today and just reserve all at keywords, but then I think inevitably we're going to have somebody come in that says that they have at keywords in their data that they would like to use.
At least put a warning in that the use of at at the beginning of any term is subject to forward compatibility issues.
I already included such a warning in the Slack, I think.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's all right in there.
Great.
Hi, Nicholas.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
Nicholas. See, okay, so the proposal is do not, Nicholas, we're talking about issue 103 right now, whether or not we're reintroducing data type as value type. And the strongest argument for that at this point is types defined already. The people that have complained about it haven't complained about it strongly enough to really warrant us adding it or changing it right now. And we've already got multiple implementations that use it, and Let's see, and people are looking to us to basically settle on the syntax, stabilize the syntax. So there don't seem to be very many advantages of reintroducing something like value type at this point in time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can agree with most of that, at least. It's apparent in context what it means. The only problem we've seen is I'm not too worried about the misunderstandings. We can always iron those out in documentation. The thing that might has been a bit of a concern for me is the fact that the at type does two things, and one of those things is as if it was just an alias for RDF type. But I mean, if we specify it clearly enough, that wouldn't be a real issue either, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. The other decision we just made is that JSON-LD keywords must not be redefined in the context. That includes that type. So you can't redefine any JSON-LD keywords. But that doesn't. We thought that didn't prevent you from specifying something like RDF type or, you know, exclamation mark type or something like that for your use in your processor.
Or just A or type.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
The important thing there is that I haven't read the algorithms closely enough to ensure that. In the compaction algorithm, if I had declared a normal keyword for type, that it would be used, that the magic of at type wouldn't sort of absorb that type triple.
Mm. Okay, and we thought the issue was with the RDF algorithm, but you're saying it could be with the compaction algorithm.
It might.
You know, if you have a document that has some other property in there, or, you know, like just RDF type instead of at type, then neither expansion nor compaction should affect that at all. Now, the expression of that property when it's expanded will expand out to using the subject reference syntax, which is an object with just at ID in it. But otherwise, it should expand and compact just fine, because we're not... particularly if we do not allow alias back at type.
Yeah, I see. My concern is when I go directly from triples to a compact form. I don't really know which path that takes through the context.
From RDF algorithm goes basically to expanded form, which you can then compact. From RDF also uses at type. So if you want to use something other than that,
at type,
then you'd need to have your own RDF from RDF algorithm. But there's nothing that says this is the only way to transform RDF into JSON-LD.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm.
Go ahead, Nicholas, and then we'll jump back to issue 103.
One of the values I've seen in having the compaction algorithm is to know from a context what kind of shape of JSON I get when I use the compaction algorithm. I don't know if framing would solve this in any way, because I need to use something other than at type for the type if type is this restricted. I need to have another keywords probably for it. It might work with aliasing, but if I want to say that it always should be in a list and I can't redefine this aliased at type either, then I have a problem.
I thought you could do it should always be in a list with... Oh, I see what you're saying.
Could you type out an example?
or rather, Nicholas, could you put the example in issue 102 so we have it on record? So that we can, I think we've been dancing around this issue a bit too long, and we really need to figure out a solution for you, or decide that this is not something that we're going to address, just because we've had this floating out there for quite a while now, and we'll revisit it during the next telecon. Okay, back to issue 103. We're basically saying we do not introduce typing value. Typing JSON-LD, JSON-LD values via something like data type or value type. Okay, so that's the proposal there. And then Nicholas, I don't know if you have a...
Well, I'm sort of this. I don't know if it breaks the indecision.
No, not for right now. It means that you could re-raise it if we go into the RDF working group, if you feel very strongly about it.
Sure. We'll see. I'll try to work out ways to not require that.
Okay. Let's see. Next issue up is issue 92. This is basically saying that JSON-LD properties must have only one list per property. The concern being that if you had if you had an alias for a property, so in the context you defined two things, A and B, and they both pointed to the same property, so something like example.com/foo hash or foo hash bar. So A and B both point to that IRI, and that IRI is supposed to be a list. So both of these items are a list. The problem comes in where you try and merge the two. I forget if it's an expansion. I think it's an expansion. So when you try to merge the two in expansion, you have absolutely no idea what the order is going to be. So in one case, even though it says it's an ordered list, one list could appear before the other one, and vice versa. So basically, this is a non-deterministic case that we don't believe we have a solution for. Go ahead.
Sorry, I don't think the problem is in expansion, because there it doesn't really matter which list comes first. I think the problem is in compaction, when we have an add container in the context and two lists, and that would end up in a list of lists.
Okay.
Because in expansion, you just have an array of add list objects, and that's completely fine. You have just several lists for that property. But in compaction, if you have for that property an add list container, you can't just drop the add list, because that would merge the two lists.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So the easiest thing is to just not to throw an error if that is detected.
But we could just throw an error if it's detected during compaction, if we support it in expansion, for example. So if you compact it back and there isn't that add container in the context, it still is completely valid.
So you could have a property with more than one list.
Yes.
But if that property had list container ship, then that would create an illegal list representation.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I guess the other question, Greg, is that didn't this also have an effect on the RDF to RDF algorithm, making it very, very difficult and or complicated?
No, the problem was with lists including lists. I don't think there's a problem to have more than one list. And if you just looked at the algorithm right now, I believe it would work.
Okay. Okay, then the proposal for this would be that a JSON-LD processor must throw an exception when it detects a property containing two lists that is itself a list container during compaction.
Yeah.
Okay, proposal. JSON-LD processor must throw an exception when it detects two lists within
two or more.
Two or more lists within a property that is itself a container list. Let's see. During compaction, a JSON-LD processor must throw an exception when it detects two or more lists within a property that is itself a container list.
Yeah, well, when expanding or when compacting to a single property, because it would be possible, just as you stated, a graph with two properties using different terms, when you compact that, the term selection process could continue to identify multiple terms. So, for instance, if I had a list of IDs and a list of dates, if I have terms that have at type XSD date and another one that's XSD ID or just that's ID, when I compact, I should pick the one for ID separately from the one for date, in which case it would not create a conflict.
Okay.
So the problem comes when you try to compact to a single to a single property where there would be multiple values, that would raise an error.
Property in the compacted output. During compaction, the JSON-LD processor must throw an exception when it detects two or more lists associated with a property that is itself a container list that will become compacted into a single property in the compacted, that will become compacted into a single property. Is that?
Basically, I think the only problem is if the IRI of that property itself is a container list, because otherwise you just don't compact it to a term but leave the full IRI in there.
Right.
I think this comes in, actually, this is really already handled, I believe. No, it's not. The place to do it is in 2.2 of the compaction algorithm.
So if in the context you specify the full IRI and set the container to at least, then you can't compact it anymore. Otherwise, it will still work. You just leave the full IRI in there and don't compact it at all.
It doesn't compact. Yeah. The problem is you might only have recognized that after you've created the first list. So it would require some backtracking.
All right. Well, as far as the proposal is concerned, is the proposal in IRC good enough, or do we need to reword it in a different way?
Maybe you should replace property with IRI, IRI property IRI, or something like that.
Let's see. Throw an exception. with the property IRI. That is itself. Could you edit that, Marcus, just so that there isn't any confusion on what you mean?
I'll try.
That works for me. Anyone else have any changes to that?
So, Marcus, did you not also suggest that we could just output using list syntax even if the property is specified to use container list, or that possibly that could just affect the term selection so that we would not select term that had container list if the value had more than one list?
Yeah, but if you associate the container at least to the full IRI, you can't select anything else. That's the problem. So you can't mint a new term which doesn't have that at container. Otherwise, that's true.
If the IRI has, if you've said that the IRI has container list, that would be the only case.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't think
you need backtracking or something to detect that, because in expansion you always have that array already, so you just, that's one check.
I think it's all contained within 2.2. And I think the term there is, it says return either the result as an array or as an object with a key of list. And it does that based upon there being a single value with list. So I think in this case, it could just be that we don't even need to say anything. We just need to clarify, perhaps through a test case, that this will not result in using a plain array syntax, and possibly also affect the IRI compaction to not select a term that has list compaction, except that leaves the odd use case where you have defined that the full URI has list compaction. I'd say in that case, you just ignore it. You just ignore it. You output, which is entirely compatible with that. You use the full ID. You don't use list compaction. And it's valid JSON LD.
So you're saying if
But it's still a list of lists then. So you have the container at least in the context and in the data.
Yeah, but even if you do that, you just don't do that compaction. So what you would output is an array of two objects, each of which contains a list.
Can you type that out?
Well, I'm not. Let's see. So if I've got,
just the data.
So if I've got that as a value with actual list contents. The concern is that if I just did simple compaction, it would look like that. And I'm just saying that all comes out of this one sentence in 2.2.
But the problem is, if you leave the at list in there and you expand it again, then you end up in a list of lists, because there's also the container list in the context.
Yeah, that's true. But then that would just raise the exception in that case. Yeah. Yeah, that would be interpreted as a list containing two lists.
Yeah, and that's really the only case we need to throw an exception in compaction if the full IRI is associated with a container list.
God, that's such a tiny, absurd case. But yes, I just hate to have to spell it out so explicitly within the. I'd say this is a case where we don't need to specify it, that it the semantics of that falls out, and we just need test cases that that show that that's the behavior.
Well, as long as it's in the text in some way. I mean, we've had a very 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 long discussion about this, which probably is an indicator that this isn't a very clear. It isn't very clear from. You know, reading the spec that this is what the outcome should be. I don't know if that's true.
Well,
or
the other thing
I mean,
just
sorry.
We sort of went back to this thing and say let's just disallow it because we don't have a use case for it, and it's easier to throw an exception for something and then readdress it and allow it later on than to try to be overly inclusive.
That's
right
true.
Now.
I'd be fine with doing that as well.
But the thing is, it's already in there. We don't support lists of lists, and if you specify the context that full RI is always a list, then you do just that. You create a list of lists.
Hmm.
So we are just, well, we just comply to the spec as it currently is. It's just a corner case that we can't resolve in compaction, but that really... So I don't think we need to disallow having multiple lists per property just because of that.
So do we need to spell out in the spec the corner cases that must be detected?
I think we should have some text in there because this is not something that's easy to pick up from even working on this stuff, right? I mean, if we're having a hard enough time of figuring out what the corner cases are, I think that the implementers would have a very difficult time kind of figuring it out, especially if they wanted to see where the spec text states that if we do a test case and they don't really understand how the spec text maps to that test case, then that's an issue as well. I think I'd much rather at least have a note in here or a warning in the spec that says, look, this is an issue. Explain clearly what the issue is and what should happen in that case. And we can say that the algorithm, if they read the algorithm carefully, it supports this, but they should know about this edge case.
So the place then to do that is in the compaction algorithm when you try to compact two lists. That would be in a, to something that uses list containership.
Container.
That would throw an exception.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Rhythm. Greg, could you put that in as a proposal?
All right.
Then Marcus, would you mind taking over scribing for Greg? Sorry, Greg, we've gone way over an hour.
It's all right.
Okay. And I'll fix the spelling on throw.
Thank you.
I think
don't think that really handles it. Because if we don't find a matching term, we always can leave the full IRI in there. The only problem is if the full IRI has a container of Atlas.
And you get more than two lists in there, throw an exception, is that what you're
saying?
Well,
I think we should just say if the term which is found through term select, actually I think this says it.
We don't always find the term. We also can just leave the full IRI in there.
No, but that compact IRI always results in something. What we should do is make the compact IRI or IRI compaction algorithm use this as a way of not selecting a term. The result will ultimately fall down to be an IRI. So when we get to the compact algorithm, if we have seen this, that means that is the case that actually happened. The term is now an absolute IRI that has list containership specified on it. That's when we would throw this exception. Otherwise, we wouldn't see this because it would have been excluded in term in IRI compaction.
I'm not sure if I follow you.
Well, let me type it out. So basically, IRI compaction, when we're selecting terms, if the value had, if there was more than one value, an array with more than one element, it would not select a term. It would not select that term. What happens then is you fall down to the last case where if all else fails, you use the absolute IRI. So that means that the only time we would see this in compaction is if we did get the absolute IRI and that absolute IRI had at container list. And that would cause us to throw an exception. But it's sufficient to just say in compaction, if the term has at container list and there's more than one value, throw an exception. These two things work together.
Okay, yeah. So the term is actually a full IRI, an absolute IRI in that instance.
Yeah, that's just because the way that the compact IRI is selected is if all else fails, use an absolute IRI.
Yeah, that's basically,
We do need to have some separate test area that looks for exceptions.
Okay,
so let's put this into a proposal. So we're saying
just want to check that. Does this sort of imply that container list doesn't match values where the value is a list of lists?
Yes.
So it's really not prohibited, it just doesn't match it.
Yes,
this is not list of lists. This is array of list. List of list is already not allowed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We already have language that prohibits that.
Yeah, set of lists. So,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Set of lists.
Yeah, that I meant that. Sorry.
So it is not disallowed. It only raises an exception in a very small corner case that you'd have to really go out of your way to make happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Greg, I'm a bit confused as to what we're plus wanting now. Are you saying that the proposal is the proposal that you wrote and the IRI
there's,
compaction
there's two
edition?
Par- yeah, two parts.
Okay.
Yeah,
let's rewrite it just to be clear about what we're plus wanting. You're doing that, Greg?
I'm doing it.
Okay.
could you clarify the should not select terms other than absolute IRIs? So shouldn't it neither absolute?
When doing IRConnect, should not select terms other than absolute IRIs. So, in other words, it ultimately would. So, any term which is a like an NC name or a Curie would be excluded from this.
Yeah.
The only reason absolute IRI is there is that that is the last thing that we do. So what happened is if you had defined that, my algorithm, my implementation would actually go and first include the absolute IRI because it was being treated like a term. It would then reject it because it meets this case. And at the very end, finding no terms or queries that meet the requirements, it would return the absolute IRI. So that's the way in which you would have that IRI selected.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
So the first part of this proposal stops the case where there is a declaration where the real absolute IRI has container list defined.
Right.
Right.
Greg Marcus just put something in IRC. I'm just trying to make sure that says effectively the same thing that yours does. I'll resolve with that one if it does.
Yes. I think it says the same thing.
Okay. Okay. So that is issue 92. We have 10 minutes left. Next up is issue 91.
Should we also say something that we allow arrays of lists? Because that was the issue really about.
Sure. Jason LD allows sets of lists. It's not arrays of lists, right?
Well, that's the same in the end.
Well, it's the array syntax, but it is a set,
Allow sets of lists via JSON's array notation as long as the associated term does not specify. Allow sets of lists.
I think we don't need the second part then, because that's already covered by this resolution.
Okay, so JSON will allow sets of lists.
Except where it conflicts with the previous resolution.
Okay, and JSON LD allows sets of lists except where it conflicts with the previous resolution. The next topic is issue 91.
This was disallowed because of the resolution on 103, right?
There are three parts to this. So we didn't resolve this because we needed to figure three things out. We've done two of them, but haven't done the last one. So the first one is hold on, let me just cut and paste Marcus's. He had because he needed...
Just a remark, when I commented issue 102, which I did when I some minutes ago, I realized that this was related, so I added a reference.
Okay. So we had postponed decision on issue 91 because we needed to talk about three things. One of them was whether or not we wanted to reintroduce data type, and we've decided that we don't want to do that right now. Two is if keywords can be refined, if JSON-LD keywords could be redefined, and we've decided that we do not allow JSON-LD keywords to be redefined. And then number three was that if there was an initial context that specifies type as syntactic sugar, so making type like
right.
any other property. And I think we have said that we don't know about initial context, but I think that we want to treat at type just as if it were any other property. Is that true?
Well, if we did that, that would get into things like allowing objects or arrays of objects that in turn have arrays of objects.
So we're saying that... Go ahead.
I think that sort of the resolution, the point number two here, that keywords cannot be redefined, then it sort of implies that they can't be defined in an initial context either because they're special.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's the gist of my problem, because I'm basically fine with 1 and 2, but I still need some way not to redefine at type, but to use the type property as just a regular link in different situations when I have very rich RDF and need to express it. If you look at the comment, the last comment on issue 102, that should... explain this problem fairly specifically. And
so
I
it's
that
just that you want to be able to express the type using set notation? Is that the issue?
Yeah,
if we were to use... I mean, if you could have at type in as a key in the context... where it just cannot contain an ID, but it could contain container set.
Yeah.
Would that do what you need?
Yep. I have seen different needs for using type as a regular link, and I need some way to say in compaction that if there is a definition for RDF type, in a context. It may be for container set, it may be to not use ID coercion or a combination. I don't want the at type mechanism to be triggered. I want just the regular term I have defined to be used when the compaction hits upon a type triple.
I think that's
so
exactly
I believe what
how it would
said
work
is you,
at the moment.
I believe what we said is you can't use ID in a if you define at type in a context. That was the gist of the previous resolutions. So the question is, can you create a context definition that uses container, language, or type?
But in his example, he doesn't use at type, but just type, just to make
exactly.
that clear.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and that I think that's working at the moment without any changes.
Right. That's true.
What happens in compaction when an RDF type triple is hit?
Nothing.
Does it go? does it look up a term for the regular RDF type IRI, and if it doesn't find it, it uses at type?
Yeah, that's one thing I was going to say. If we do that, if we make that change, if that change isn't already there, that would address Nicholas's issue. So
yeah,
it would be that the term selection algorithm.
I think there's actually something in IRI compaction. The very first step of IRI compaction is to see if the IRI is RDF type, and if so, return at type. So this would affect that.
Yes.
Was that a recent change, correct? Because that wasn't in there before.
Yes, we redid IRI compaction in order to deal with the term selection semantics.
Okay.
So that was part of that.
So if we would remove that first step and move that to from RDF, then it would work for
Nicholas.
No,
we need a way. Actually, maybe it's only from RDF that we need that.
Because during expansion, we don't expand at type to the full IRI anyway.
No, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's sufficient, is to override that selection in just the from RDF and remove it from IRI compaction. And I think that solves Nicholas' issue. If you have a property which expands to RDF type, it would be it wouldn't be affected by IRI compaction or any other expansion or compaction algorithm.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what the word was before.
It would be useful to create some test cases for that, Nicholas.
I'll add it to my calendar and please remind me if I fail to do so.
Okay. All right. Nicholas, do you agree that this addresses your issue?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So the proposal is this in two places we need to make this change, Greg?
Yes. We have to change compact IRI to not expand RDF type to at type. And then we have to change from RDF to expand, or rather to represent RDF type as at type. In fact, I'm not even sure we have to change it. Let me look. Yeah, no, we already have that. Step 5.6. If property is RDF type, then append the string representation using that type. So it looks like it's already covered.
Okay, hold on. In which algorithm? Compact IRI or from RDF?
In convert from RDF algorithm.
Okay,
so we just need to drop it from compact.
Yeah.
Just need to from compact IRI.
Yeah.
Okay, so IRI. Change the compact IRI algorithm to not expand RDF type to at type.
Right.
Yes.
Should it not, or should, I mean, as a last resort it should, otherwise it would never be, if there is no type, we should, I mean, if there's no definition of type in context, shouldn't we put at type there?
Carol, may I put a proposal? Yeah, I think you're probably right as a last resort.
Hey, Marcus, I'm getting a lot of feedback from your mic again.
I'm sorry.
There we go. Better. Greg, you're putting a proposal in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why would we need that fallback mechanism?
because if someone who generates JSON-LD from RDF with using compaction and this context they use has not defined any regular term for RDF type, I think it would be expected that that type would be used.
But according to the spec, you would do that from with the convert from RDF algorithm and not directly via compaction, because compaction doesn't take an RDF input. So I don't think we need to do that anyway.
Well, I think that someone else might, there might be other ways to get JSON-LD that did this. We might, for instance, be applying a context to some existing JSON that's had that representation. And this would just allow it to get back to the right form. So I don't see any harm in doing this. And it does seem like it does what is necessary in the 99% case.
Yeah. We can always Well, Marcus, because we can always remove the last step later on if it's unnecessary. Is that your concern? Is that this is unnecessary?
I'm not sure if it creates problems if you expand and compact again. That's what I'm currently thinking about.
Let's see, if you expand and compact.
Because if you would expand it, you lose the context. And if you compact it again, you might don't want to end up with add type, but you still would like to keep the full IRI, for example.
I'm back. Yeah, but if you use you specify a context when you compact again, right?
But you might not be interested in that add type magic there. And then the compaction might fail because it isn't just a string anymore, for example.
Well, there are two issues there. One of them is that I don't think that we expect compaction and expansion to be a round trippable thing, right? I think that's fine. If you compact and expand, I don't necessarily think that we need to make sure that you get the same thing. When you do that, as long as the meaning's the same, which is true in this case, I don't think that we have an issue, right?
Let's assume we use one of Nicholas' old examples where he had a value of add type, which was an object which contained some properties. If we expand that, we will get to the full IRI, and if we compact it back, we would magically have an add type with an value of an object with multiple properties, which we don't support. So we would end up with invalid JSON-LD with that fallback mechanism. Because currently the value of add type can just be a string or an array of strings, not an object or an array of objects. And if we have that fallback mechanism, we could produce invalid JSON-LD just because of that.
But we just moved the step in the compaction algorithm. I don't see how that would change.
It would change because the value space, the lexicon of add type, is just string or array of string. And if we take your example, where you had that label in the type at the same time, so you had RDF type and then you had an object with an ID and the label of that type, and we would expand that and compact it back, then we would
just you and me, Nicholas.
Yeah.
Hey, can you stay on after the call for a bit so we can talk about your RDFA lab?
JSON-LD. Yeah, sure. For a while at least.
Yeah.
15, 20 minutes, I'm pretty sure I can stay.
No, I think it's just a small issue.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Just waiting for Mono.
Yeah.
Can you mute again, Marcus?
Yes, sure. Just typing out an example.
So I think that what we might need to do then is to say that at type can only be selected if the values are a string or an array of strings.
No, it's not what the values are. I think it's if the if there is no subject definition for the value.
But is there really a compelling use case to have that fallback mechanism in? Because I don't really see any.
Well, I guess which fallback mechanism? The one where you don't pick at type if it's got...
So if there is no term defined for RDF type, you fall back to at type automatically.
Uh-huh.
Do we need that for any use case?
Okay. So if we just don't put that step back in, then that addresses your concern.
Yes. So we just remove that step from compact IRI.
So
that's
how
fine.
Does... Okay.
Someone can
because...
always then add the... Actually, does that allow someone to add something in that would cause it to be selected?
No.
I guess I'm confused as to how at type gets selected if that's the case. If you have an RDF type and you don't have anything else, if you have the full IRI and you go to compact, how does at type get in there?
At type is in
yeah.
there because for expansion and compaction, it was always in there. It's really not affected. Through expansion and compaction, it's if you had JSON-LD that had RDF type in there, without putting something in the IRI compaction, it would not be automatically turned into at type.
Yeah.
And the only
yeah,
way that that would get there is through some non-native JSON-LD or through some other from RDF algorithm.
So if you go from, let's see, if you have JSON-LD from the from RDF algorithm, and if you don't have a definition for a term for type there, what happens then? You get at type.
Well, could I create a context that had RDF type has an ID of at type? Would that do it?
You could do that. That would be an alias, yeah.
Yeah, that's an alias.
So that would actually result in your, when you expanded, of turning RDF type into, or even the full IRI version of that, into at type and would accomplish what you wanted to do without having to have an explicit operation in IRI compaction.
Exactly.
Yes.
Then I'd say let's just amend the proposal to remove step one.
Yeah, that's what I would propose as well, yeah.
Okay, so the proposal is remove step one in the IRI compaction algorithm.
I think that does it.
Okay, how is type selected again? It's done elsewhere in that.
If you look at the from RDF algorithm, I think it's step 5.3 or something. If it sees RDF type, it uses that type.
Sees RDF type, uses that type. Okay.
It's in step 5.6.
Okay.
Property is RDF type. Append the string representation of the object to the array for the value of at key at type. Creating an entry and value if necessary.
Okay.
And that's if we haven't found a term for RDF type. Or?
No. So we would need to, we don't look at a context here. So no, if the solution for what you want to do is to not use this algorithm. You use a custom algorithm that does not do that step.
Yeah, and that's not what I want. I want to be able to use the official algorithms and be able to use another term than at type for RDF type.
Then we would need to add some option to from RDF to override that.
Yes. And remove this rule in compaction.
I think let's remove the rule. So one proposal is out there. Remove that step. So I'm going to plus one.
Yeah.
Then the second proposal would be to add an option to the convert from RDF algorithm that causes it to skip step 5.6.
If let's see.
Manu, do you resolve that or do I have to do that?
I can resolve it. I'm just waiting to hear what the second part of the proposal is in case it affects the first part of the proposal.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So this convert from RDF, it doesn't take... what was your proposal, Greg? To add an option
to
the algorithm?
The from RDF algorithm that causes it to skip 5.6.
Right, like no magic type or whatever.
Yeah, so it just falls through and it goes down into the otherwise clause in what's now 5.8.
Yeah. I was just wondering. No, right. That's the key. Okay, yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, so the proposal is to add an option to the from RDF algorithm to skip step. What was it? 5.6.
5.6. If property is RDF type.
If property is RDF type, okay. So add an option from the to the from RDF algorithm to skip step 5.6 to support the use of a term in place of type keyword. During conversion from RDF to JSON LD. Okay. So that?
Yes. And that's good because that leaves this up to those with very specific RDF needs to control it, and it doesn't pollute anything for anyone else.
Okay, good. So that is issue 91. That is all the time. We've actually gone 12 minutes over. Great. Thank you, everyone, for the call. And we're going to meet back next week and do this all over again until we're done with the issues. Is that right?
Yeah.
Hopefully we won't be at this for another year. All right, guys, have a great week.
Thank you.
Can Nicholas stay on for a couple of minutes?
Sure.
Yeah, I'll stay.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Hey, guys.
Bye, guys.
Greg, did you need me on the phone for a couple minutes or no? Just you and Nicholas?
No, it's just an issue with trying to run Nicholas RDFA to JSON LD and Node.
Okay.
To figure out.
Okay. Great. Okay. Talk to you guys on Thursday. Bye.
Yes.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
So I put this up as an issue just so you had it there. I don't know if you actually saw that or you're just too involved with right now.
I managed to cast a glimpse. I left.
Yeah, you had said that this can be done in Node with JSON JS DOM, which I don't know if that means that you actually did that or not.
Yes, I've done that. I've used JS DOM, and I hit. I think that the problem is, I was also expecting RDFA JSON, that object, to turn up on the window object actually, but it didn't attach to that, even
so
when I explicitly.
I found if I put window.rdfa.json that it worked, but I got an error in RDF.json that there was no document. If I ran that, it says, what does it say? It says, first argument must be string or buffer. Actually, I'm not sure where
right.
that's from.
Let's see if I have my, I'm just going to write, save an example here.
I mean, if you have a working sort of distiller that does this, then that would be great. Because I just was going to run this on my own machine, and then I could run the test suite against it. I don't know if you've done that.
No, I haven't. I have actually gotten halfway to where you were starting. So we're almost meeting in the middle here, I think, and that's great. So I'm going to take the stuff you did. I have a started one script which is intended to use to run Node and run a web service on Node for this.
Right.
Previously, I've just used a one-off script which uses Node for command line usage, and that works. So I need to just fuse that one with your stuff, and then we should have a working solution.
Well, this is my first attempt at doing anything with Node. There's a debugger service that you can point to it, which I haven't gotten to work either, which would be really very nice to be able to work with. But it seems
right,
like this should work. And the only problem is the window.document didn't actually seem to result in the document that was retrieved. And that's not really your problem, I guess. It's a problem that I'm having with JS DOM.
Yeah, it's strange. I would like to use, because I used your pattern originally and it didn't work, and then I reverted to what I used in my original script, which was to require the RDFA JSON file.
Okay, and I just didn't understand how require looked like it was using a package. And here I just reference your GitHub URL, which obviously isn't very good for development. But is there something you can do that tells it to require from your local directory or something?
Yes. If you use .dot, I use actually ..slash in my because I have a tools folder where I put this. And then you just remove the file suffix of .js, and it works.
Okay, so if you created a var for RDF to a RDFA JSON, and you remove the URL in the env of JS DOM, then you would invoke it with RDFA JSON .extract. Lowercase? Is that how that would work? Or the
use both. The extract is just an alias for creating an instance and returning.
Would you have time to actually create like a distiller file in your repo that actually does this?
Yeah, I haven't been able to sit down with this at all since the weekend, so maybe even tonight, although I'm pretty tired. I've been at a conference for 2 days.
What conference are you at?
It's a local one here in Stockholm. It's for Agile. It's called Agile Sweden, which is most of my colleagues from many years. And it's fairly many people, around 200, talk about Agile development in general. Pretty nice. Lots of open space discussions, which is perfect form of unconference.
Nice. Yeah, so, my objective was, I mean, I would like to get into this more, although I might, my time might go away if I ended up taking a job that I look it looks like I might get from Wikia.
All right.
But, I would like to get this. I would like to be able to run the test suite against it and figure out how to do that.
But I have some almost working stuff which I will push to GitHub in the next couple of days at least. So I'm pretty sure that I will have this working within the end of the week.
All right. You don't have any insight into why that window.document argument might not work here.
No, and that's pretty much the annoying part, because I tried to use exactly the same mechanism that you did, and for some reason it failed, it glitched. Yeah. And I'll try to figure out why that is. It might be a bug in JS DOM.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
But I'll investigate that, because I really want to test that solution.
Right.
It's a bit more...
What I thought I might have done before when I cloned this was figure out a way to invoke this, invoke your library without having to run it in Node and point the RDFA test suite at it.
Yeah,
This is how I do it in Ruby. I use RSpec, and basically cache all of the tests so that I interpret the manifest, and I just run each one separately with my own Sparkle interpreter, and it runs, it's orders of magnitude faster than trying to do it through a web server, which I thought getting that to work would improve the development cycle of the development of the actual library.
Yeah. The thing, interesting thing there is which Sparkle engine to use. I haven't actually tried the RDFlibJS, the Antonio Garrott's implementation. I haven't examined that in detail in depth yet. But
if I could run the whole thing from Ruby somehow, the problem is just getting the data back out of JavaScript. Then I could just use my existing test infrastructure.
Yeah.
That was my thought.
Yeah.
But better would be to have something that worked entirely within Node, which would have to be Antonio's library, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. If it's compliant enough, but. I'll start off by trying to... Do you have a repo on GitHub with your Ruby RSpec runner?
Yes. It's just my RDFA library gem.
All right. Then
you can
get check
that
out.
And then if you have any experience in running Ruby stuff, it sounds like you're not afraid to venture into new languages.
No, I'm fairly polyglot, as they say.
Yeah, if you just download that with a suitable Ruby environment and you do a bundle install and then a bundle exec of RSpec /suite spec, it will run them all. I use TextMate, and you can run it straight from within TextMate, which is nice.
Right. I use Vim. I think there are lots of plugins from
Yeah, there might be. There's probably Ruby RSpec plugins for that as well. There's a formatting mode in RSpec for TextMate, which is just like the other. It's also the HTML form. It's a slight variation on that, but it gives you nice, green, yellow, or red output for all of your specs.
All right. I'll look into that as well. I have a bunch of colleagues who use Ruby and Vim. They might also have some tips if I manage to
Yeah.
Fine. Call them out and see what they do. But
that's great. So if we can get that working, and if my schedule allows it, I'd like to work to try to improve the coverage of your CoffeeScript library here, because it's pretty cool. Did you look at using converting your Clojure to ClojureScript?
Well, actually, I did one very quick test almost more than a month ago, and as expected, it choked on different parts. But I haven't really done that again. And to some extent, I work to make it pluggable using protocols. But I suspect that ClojureScript is a fairly crippled version of the Clojure. It's not a real implementation. It's surface
it's
implementation.
Not Clojure. It's better than JavaScript to Java, but it's not the full thing. But what I saw is it does allow fully optimizable JavaScript using Google's JavaScript. I guess they have their own Clojure thing, which does a lot of optimization. So my guess is that it would result in pretty performant code. But
that it would be as best as possible given the functional approach I did. But what I also wanted to try in the CoffeeScript implementation was to just leverage the statefulness of JavaScript, given that creating a JSON LD output also sort of is just building a tree. So it's
I understand that multi-core JavaScript is in the works. So
all right,
functional programming would really work well with that.
Yeah,
but
that's
anyway,
true.
Wait for the future. I think the CoffeeScript. I thought about doing the RDFA test suite in a CoffeeScript too, but just decided to stay away from that for the time being.
Yeah, I am a bit conflicted about. I really like writing most of my stuff in CoffeeScript when I do tests, but it works very well until you get into corners, because the way you can reduce using Rubyisms and the white space indentation stuff put together makes certain expressions very brittle. It's easy to type, but very hard to read, and if you change some things, you might get spooky results if you don't really know where to put your commas and things like that.
Yeah, that's scary. And maybe they went a little bit too far. It's interesting, given that it's a sort of a Ruby group that did it, that it has a lot more in common with Python in some respects.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting amalgam of the two. It really works very well for most of the cases, but I think that they've done a bit too much in terseness at certain places, which makes it unpredictable. It's a very complicated parser, as I've understood as well. Some parser implementers have frowned upon it from that point of view. It takes a lot of the pain out of JavaScript, so it's easy to get going.
If you could send a reference or maybe just reply to the issue with whatever you had done in Node for a command line runner, that would be pretty useful to work with.
Yeah, right. That's true. I should put that up. I have it. I just haven't added it and pushed it. So I should commit it and have it as a part of the repository.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, because that would help me to try to continue to work with it some more before you have a chance to.
Yes, I'll make sure to do that tonight.
Great. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you too.
Talk to you later.
We'll talk to you on Thursday then.
Yes, all right.
Yes, cool. Bye.